She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And you're certainly going to be given the opportunity to think about something so important today, and that is the health of our oceans. The name of our show is The Blue Heart of Our Planet, and it is truly an honor and a privilege, and I say that with all sincerity, to introduce our guest for the next hour, because she is the blue heart of our planet. National Geographic Society Explorer in Residence, Dr. Sylvia Earle, called her deepness by The New Yorker and The New York Times, living legend by the Library of Congress, and first hero for the planet by Time Magazine. She is an oceanographer, author, explorer, and lecturer. She has experience as a field research science, government official, and director for many corporate and nonprofit organizations. She has authored numerous scientific and technical and popular publications. But the most important thing to me is that I'm sure her heart does beat blue. So, Dr. Earle, thank you. This was quite an effort to make it possible. And I look at your schedule and the number of conferences you're going to, and I'm like, I'm exhausted. So thanks for staying with it. I really, really appreciate it. And so do our thousands of listeners. So
I'm delighted to be on board.
I am so glad you're on board. It just speaks volumes about your commitment and your life's work to really preserve something that's, to me, at great risk, our oceans. I mean, really, really, really at great risk. So let's start about, I'd love to start with what you got excited about, and you talked about New Jersey. So let's recover that, since I'm a Jersey girl. And where did you get knocked
over?
I am a Jersey girl, so that got me excited. Where did you get knocked over by the wave that made you fall in love?
Well, in the Jersey Shore. Ocean City. I was 3 years old. The ocean got my attention, but what has captured and held my attention all these years, I mean, I love the water for the sake of the water itself, but it's life in the ocean, the great diversity that is there and nowhere else in the universe, certainly not on Earth. Starfish, you know, and jellies, and many variations on the theme of invertebrate animals that are very clear and abundant in the ocean, but just don't occur anywhere else. And I, even as a kid, I could see that the ocean was really where the action is. So when my parents moved to Florida when I was 12, my backyard was the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, wow.
And so it was heaven on earth for me as a kid.
And when you talk about the oceans, I mean, you think about kids, and I go back to learning how to swim in the oceans, not being afraid, and just the magic of the tides going in and out and exploring the landscape when they were out and the things you could find and, you know, digging down for clams. I mean, it is so easy to fall in love with. So one of the things that struck me is I listened to your interview with Ira Flatow, because I just had him on my show last week. And you did an interview in 2009, right when your book came out, about The World is Blue, how our fate and oceans are one. And I listened to the interview, and what struck me is that it was over 6 years ago, and it could have been like it was yesterday. So it's like, okay, 6 years later, where are we? But share with our listeners what the book is about, and why did you write it?
Well, somehow, once you understand that the world is in trouble, the ocean is in trouble, and that we, therefore, are in trouble, I suggest to others the same advice that I give to myself. Use whatever powers you have to try to make a difference, to communicate to others what you see. And as a scientist over the years, I've had some special opportunities to see what others mostly do not get a chance to see. And it's pretty selfish for me to keep that to myself.
You had to share it.
Share the view. In fact, I was inspired as a child reading books by William Beebe, for example, who described what it was like to dive a half a mile beneath the surface in a little submersible that he and an engineer friend, Otis Barton, constructed. I mean, they didn't buy it off the shelf. They made it. They dreamed it up, and then they made their dream come true. And the observations that they made, they chose to share them. And I, although I never got to meet William Beebe nor Otis Barton, I did get to see through their eyes what it was like to be deep in the heart of the ocean. They were the first ones to go as deep as they went, and it was only half a mile. The average depth of the ocean is 2.5 miles. Average depth, maximum 7 miles. So they were still scratching the surface, and actually here now many years later, we have not made a whole lot of progress about going readily into the great depths. But following Beebe and Barton in the 1930s came Cousteau, Jacques Cousteau.
Right.
And his engineer ally, Emile Gagnon, who came up with a concept for SCUBA, self-contained breathing apparatus, and I'm one of the beneficiaries of that. Reading Cousteau's writings and later his films, again, motivated me as a kid to think, maybe I can do something like that. So in writing The World is Blue, I was perhaps hoping deep down in my heart that others might be able to see what I've had the privilege of seeing and realize that if I can do this, you can do this, and that they might want to go out and see for themselves. And the earlier book that I wrote in 1995 called Sea Change, A Message of the Ocean, I've done some kids' books too, 4 of them with a National Geographic, and I don't know, a lot of books since then. The most recent one is called Blue Hope, also with a National Geographic, talking about marine protected areas, hope spots, that if we can secure protection for critically important and also critically endangered places in the sea, we actually might be able to hold the line and turn what is currently a very alarming trend of loss in the sea as well as on the land, and therefore sort of a dim-looking future for ourselves. But we can turn it around. But it starts with knowing. And how do people get to know what others see, and how do you communicate? Well, historically, a lot has been accomplished with books, and they will continue to do so. I mean, I love electronic books, and I certainly embrace the new electronic media. I'm armed wherever I go with my computer and my cell phone and whatever it takes. I'm a techie, if you will, and I have all kinds of equipment to enhance my ability to communicate, but also technology that enables me to go explore the ocean, below where I can go holding my breath, below where I can go scuba diving. And I'm working with my daughter and son-in-law, who now own and operate a company that I started called Deep Ocean Exploration and Research. And thank you, William Beebe. You got me started with that.
Yes. And that wave hitting you in New Jersey way back when?
Oh, that's exactly right. And so they're building little submersibles and remotely operated vehicles and other equipment to really make possible enhanced access. We're just beginning to turn the corner on that. You know, early days of aviation, early in the 20th century, and now, although there have been military submarines, nuclear submarines, very powerful and sophisticated systems, for people, just everybody, almost anyone can get on an airplane, and almost anybody can get in a car, and or a boat. They're means of transportation high in the sky and all over the land. But to get under the surface, we're still in the early stages to make it publicly available. Like Hertz Rent-A-Sub. They don't exist yet.
Oh,
but
my
they
gosh,
will.
I can't wait. Yes. Because the opportunities are so different and so limited in terms of exploring what lies beneath. I mean, it's there's the whole social divide of, you know, affordability and all of that as well. I mean, there's a whole social justice piece that I don't want to go off on a tangent, but it's like, it's now very, it's just not easily accessible, as you said. So that's what you're doing to change it.
And well, there are millions of divers now.
Right.
And when I was a child in New Jersey and early days in Florida, there were no dive centers where you could go get tanks and no courses that you could take to learn how to be a diver. But, you know, now essentially almost anyone can sign up and do that. And, I mean, my mother was 81 before she actually put on a face mask and fins and took to the ocean. And then once she realized, oh, looking at fish, swimming in something other than lemon slices and butter, they're really cool. I mean, she'd seen fish in an aquarium, but seeing them on their own terms is qualitatively different. And I love aquariums because they're like halfway houses for people and fish. But it's not the same as taking yourself out into the ocean and actually realizing this is the living system that really is a cornerstone of what makes life on Earth, all of life on Earth, not just for the creatures that live in the sea, but all life. We're all sea creatures in a way because, you know, elephants need the ocean. Trees need the ocean. We need the ocean. All living things. Well, we could not exist if Earth did not have an ocean. That's where 97% of Earth's water is. It's where water originates that goes up into the sky as clouds and falls back on land and sea. Trees give off water and it goes back up as clouds, but most of the water that's in clouds originate over the ocean. It's not just the surface of the ocean, or that sort of dominates the face of the world. It's the fact that the ocean does have this great depth, 2.5 miles, this average depth. That's where the Titanic rests. When you think about the ocean, most people who get acquainted with the ocean, it's along the shore, along the edges.
Right.
And yet the deep blue heart of the planet is out there, beyond the edge, in the high seas. It's where most of the oxygen that we breathe is generated and replenished every day, every hour, every minute. And thank goodness it continues, because that's what makes this planet function. The chemistry of the planet shaped by life in the sea. And it isn't just generating oxygen and capturing carbon, photosynthesis driving the great ocean food webs. It's that what we are doing to the ocean in terms of the chemistry of the ocean, basically altering its nature. The ocean is becoming more acidic owing to what we're putting into the ocean of air above, into the skies above, and much of it now is going into the ocean as well. And that carbon dioxide is becoming transformed into carbonic acid. The ocean has absorbed so much of the excess carbon that humans have generated through the burning of fossil fuels in recent decades, that there just comes a point when the amount of CO2 that the ocean can absorb, they can't take in more as CO2, that what comes in becomes carbonic acid. And that's something that we've noticed over the past decade. Never before in human history has there been a situation like what we are now witnessing and, in fact, causing.
Like not ever. And, you know, you in some of your materials you talk about, we really do have an awareness about the trees and how much oxygen they provide. But you help us understand that the oceans really do the heavy lifting. And you say things like, you know, they grab carbon. I mean, people, this is really important. They're taking carbon out of the air and providing us oxygen. So,
and food for life in the sea. They drive the great ocean food webs. I used to, when I was a student many years ago, I had a bumper sticker as a botanist. I really loved this bumper sticker that I said, "Have you thanked a green plant today?" It was just acknowledgement that animals need plants.
Right.
We don't ourselves photosynthesize, but it's so great that plants do, because in the process of photosynthesis, they capture the sunlight, the energy from sunlight, and in the presence of chlorophyll with carbon dioxide and water, synthesize simple sugars that are the base of the food chains that most of life on Earth relies on. I mean, the plants depend on that process for their energy, but they then pass what they capture and hold on to the animals that consume them. And that would be us, among others, the birds, the fish in the ocean, all life, all animal life. Now, in the ocean, and it was only in fairly recent times, in the late 1970s, that an alternative to photosynthesis, that is capturing energy that does not require sunlight, it takes the right chemicals under the right circumstances with the right bacteria to chemosynthesize, to capture the ingredients, to synthesize food, synthesize their themselves, basically the bacteria that prosper, that are then consumed by other creatures and right up the food chain to larger things, including fish. And in some cases, we eat the fish that eat the sustenance that is generated by the deep sea creatures. But actually, it's only in very recent times that we have gone into the very deep sea to capture anything that we consume. The ocean has been largely protected, untouched by human influence, protected by inaccessibility, true of polar areas too, the high Arctic, Antarctica. The edges of the Arctic have been populated by humans, of course, for thousands of years, but on a limited basis. But that is now changing rapidly as the planet warms, the ice melts, and accessibility has greatly increased, mostly in the latter part of the 20th century. So places that historically, you know, humans have not been able to get to for whatever reasons.
What lies beneath.
Yeah, that's right. Now we can. Technology and the changing planet make this possible.
It sounds ridiculous to say this, but it is such a tip of the iceberg when it comes to the ocean. And I remember the first time when I went to Machu Picchu, standing there and looking out, and we were lucky enough to have this guide who was from the area. And I said to him, is there so much out there that we've never, you know, is there some untouched part? Can we still think about discovering another tribe? And he said, absolutely. But you can see it. You know what I mean? It's like you can see the canopy and you can understand that it's there, but the vastness of the oceans, you know, for most people, it really is a vacation. And I know there are many, many more people diving and all of that, but for the vast majority of people who aren't fishermen for their life, the oceans are the abyss. I mean, it's unbelievable. And speaking of abyss, you talked about hope spots and your involvement with exploring those. Tell us about Mission Blue. And I kept reading about you and saying, going down the rabbit hole, okay, so that's not enough. I think I'll start Mission Blue after I do this, go to conferences, write books, explore the ocean. And I really do say that sincerely. You care a lot about public education and getting public support to get excited about the ocean. So tell us about Mission Blue.
Well, I think part of my motivation is that I have three children, and I have four grandsons. This is one good reason for having children. You can get grandchildren that way.
Yes. My husband says that's the only reason to have children, and I get mad at him, but he's a grandpa. And he goes, next time I'm going to skip that hard middle part and just go straight to the grandchildren.
Both are rather wonderful.
Yes, they are indeed. Yes.
I think of them as kids, and of course they're kids old enough to have kids of their own, but in any case, I just see the future through their eyes, and I cannot just sit back knowing what I know and not do everything in my power to share the view and let others see what I see. And also, I do a lot of listening and looking and trying to grasp and understand what others know and see, and then help put it together. This is the great era of synthesizing more insight into the big questions about who we are and where we have come from and where we're going and how are we going to get to wherever that place is that we hope for in the future. So one answer to that is understanding that, like no other creature on earth, humans really are blessed with the capacity to look back in time,
right,
and to come up with answers to how old is the earth, what is the solar system, what are those sparkly things up in the sky. It's taken many generations of people whose intelligence is probably not any different from the level of intelligence that we have today, but they passed what they knew along generation after generation, developed the alphabet, developed numbers, developed some understanding of what life is about. And today, as never before, kids are, they have access to, they
everything.
And we, all of us, well, we're the beneficiaries,
yes,
of all preceding learning. And we don't have to learn how to start from scratch to make a telephone or build a car or weave clothes. And it wasn't long ago that some of those things were necessary by everyone everywhere, but we're the luckiest generation ever to come along, because we are not only armed with knowledge, but we have an opportunity, knowing what we know, anticipating the future, to make a choice. What kind of future do we want? It was a question asked at the United Nations conference in Brazil. Was Rio plus 20 in 2012. What is the future we want? And it's something that every human being probably at some point has tried to imagine. What kind of future do I want? Knowing that people are empowered with knowledge, and even if your resources are slim, even if food is a tricky business that every day you have to think about, where can I find food or a place to sleep or where is the water, we have choices. But as never before, there are enough people of the 7 billion on the planet who have access to the latest and greatest insight, knowledge, and the capacity to do something positive about shaping the future that is suitable to maintain a planet that works in our favor. Or we could just let it go. Business as usual means just following the current trends that do not bode well for, not just for the future of fish and whales and trees and things, but we're all tied together in this. What we're doing to nature, we're doing to ourselves. And it's clear now, as never before, that we have altered the nature of nature, changing the temperature of the planet through our actions. Not intending to, we're unwittingly change things that are not in our favor. We've contaminated the ocean and the freshwater as well. With all the best intentions in the world, we've clear-cut the wilderness and turned forests into cities, forests into farms. At the time, it seemed like a good thing to do. And then you look around and you say, well, where are all the trees? Oh, there are a few left over here. Maybe we should save some. And it's taken us a while to understand that nature keeps us alive. And now we have to return the favor. We consciously have to protect the skies, the waters, the life, the fabric of life that makes our lives possible. We didn't know. I mean, half a century ago when I began exploring the ocean, we thought the ocean was too big to fail. We did. We thought our job was to go out and kill things, to capture ocean wildlife and turn it into commodities.
Right. Infinite supply.
They'll recover. That's right.
They'll recover.
And even with taking fossil fuels, we act as if that they will continue no matter what. We dig coal, we drill for oil and gas, and all that has served us very well for this very short period of time. But we burn through non-renewable assets. The good news is they've given us knowledge. They have powered civilization to the point where we can share knowledge with the devices that we've created, armed with the energy that we've taken from the great asset base that is not renewable. But we are learning how to find other ways to power our civilization. It doesn't mean a step backwards. It means definitely a step forward to harness the sun directly instead of harnessing fossilized sunlight. That would be coal, oil, and gas.
Right.
And to instead take the shortcut. Let's go directly to the source and let's channel it in ways that really are give us a better chance than continuing with the old ways of doing things to really, now that we've identified the problems, take action that can address those problems. The biggest problem would be ignorance. It has been in the past.
Yes.
But now we know. And now we can take what we know and shape the future that we want, not the future that we'll just have to live with because we don't have choices. We do have choices, but we're running out of time. When we're down to 4% of bluefin tuna in the Pacific, 10% of the sharks globally, from what was there when I began exploring the ocean in the middle of the 20th century, when you see the decline of wildlife because we have used our technologies on a scale that nothing has preceded our capacity to extract wildlife from the ocean, clear-cutting the ocean the way we clear-cut the forests, but thinking that it could recover and will recover, but now we have evidence. We don't have to think wishfully anymore. We can just look at what's happened and say, hope spots. We must protect areas on the land like national parks, and in the sea, like marine protected areas,
right,
hope spots, whatever you want to call them, marine reserves. For the National Geographic, a project that has identified about 20 places in the ocean that are still in pretty good shape, really good shape. I mean, there's no place that is exactly pristine in the ocean, but these come as close as we can find. And my fellow explorer in residence, Enrique Sala, has been leading this effort so that by 2020, these 20 areas, if all goes well, can be put in the bank, basically, a security area to help restore and recover what's been lost. But it's not enough all by itself, as important as that is. We need to look at places like Chesapeake Bay, like the Gulf of Mexico, like the areas and coastal areas and in the high seas all over the world, places that have been damaged but with care can recover, or at least be better than they would be if we do nothing.
And there's a whole education piece to this, because one of the boards I sit on is dedicated to the protection of the whole area for the Sea of Cortez. It's the SADO board, and it's just so amazing to me, because what you know, what I know, what I think a lot of other people know is, when you're talking about fishermen in the Sea of Cortez, is a perfect example. It's all they've ever done. It's all they've ever known. It was the land of plenty. Their fathers did it. Their grandfathers did it. It's their life. It is their blood that feeds their families. And the education process for there is no more. It's going away. We're destroying the beds where the spawning beds, and then providing some alternatives like ecotourism and diving and those other things. But it's really a process, because sometimes just to know better doesn't necessarily help people do better. Does that make sense?
It does. But here's the caveat to this, that when fishermen are feeding their families and their communities and their livelihoods,
right,
not just their livelihoods, but their life is directly connected, their source of sustenance, that's one thing. But what has really changed, and it's changed in the last century, the last half century, but it's continuing to change, this is not so much about feeding families and community.
Right.
This is about feeding a luxury taste that has been marketed to people, like tuna.
So true.
When I was a child, nobody ate tuna fish. Tuna fish was considered, I hate the term, but anyway, trash fish. And not something to be given high regard. But we have been convinced through marketing to think that, oh, tuna this, tuna that, you know, tuna fish sandwiches and sushi and sashimi. We've been taught, it's a learned behavior. It's a marketed behavior. Shrimp that once was a rarity. You know, you have to go to a place near where shrimp lived to have shrimp on the menu, like around the Gulf of Mexico. But now you get popcorn shrimp doing this, that, the other thing, everywhere, thousands of miles from where those creatures originally lived. And it's happened mostly in recent decades, even in the deep waters of Antarctica, where Chilean sea bass, where orange roughy, where krill are captured on a scale that there's no possible way that you could think of this as sustainable. We are newcomers extracting on a scale for which there's absolutely no precedent in the history of the animals who live in these areas. The deep sea, like orange roughy, these are animals that take 25 years to mature, about like young male sperm whales, about 25
right.
years invested in growing up to be a part of their whale society. And when to go to market, some of the fish that we see now readily available in restaurants as well as the marketplace, orange roughy is one example that may be 100 years old or more. It's ridiculous to think of these as creatures that can be taken, quotes, sustainably. We've seen them just in a few decades go from abundance to a great drop-off in their numbers, harder and harder to find, catch, and market creatures that once were abundant. But that was the result of not having ever had predation by humans before. And then it doesn't take long for us to chew away at what had existed as a, quotes, untapped resource.
And the things that you do, like when you're talking about this, I'm sitting there, and what so hit me in almost everything I looked at that you've done is that you can consider it a very selfish act to care about the oceans, or selfless, because to me, it's not what you say. It's that the health of our oceans is vital to our own health, to the air we breathe, to the supply of food that is available. Let's talk about farm factories for fish. Like, the whole thought of it makes me sick, because that's what happened. Farm-raised fish. I haven't found any really great arguments in favor of it, but you're right. People's insatiable appetite for consuming this, their delicacies. We can go off about the oysters, but there is a part of this where, pay attention, everybody. This is about your life and your breathing and your oxygen and health. That was my little rant, because it's like, people, you can really make this about you if you want to, because the oceans are vital to your existence.
The reality is that what appears in markets as, quotes, seafood, sea life, It's wildlife. It's taken us a while, but we no longer tend to take songbirds commercially,
right,
or ducks and geese commercially, right, to market. But early in the 20th century, it was still being done. We managed to eliminate some of the creatures that were the most abundant, like passenger pigeons. Literally billions of them filled the skies over North America, but they're all gone. We got to the point where the deaths exceeded the births, if you will, the hatchlings of birds, and there comes a point where they just disappear. The last one, few, disappeared in zoos. And in the ocean, we are with a 90% drop of many of the fish that we so love to eat in a space of less than half a century. I mean, a few decades, we've unraveled systems and species that have been around for literally millions of years. It's crazy that we haven't awakened to what we're actually doing. I mean, if we went into a restaurant and they had snow leopard and rhinoceros and elephant and eagles and owls,
right,
on the menu, we'd probably say,
outraged.
Wait a minute. No, it's like, this can't be. But we're taking their equivalents in terms of ocean wildlife that have greatly diminished in their numbers in a few decades, and yet we're still taking them on the basis that, well, it's marketing. We've been sold a bill of goods, if you will, thinking that it's okay. Well, it isn't okay. Not if you do your homework, look at the numbers, think about what your appetite is, what it really costs to the ocean systems, whether it's halibut or cod or salmon or tuna or grouper or snapper, or go down the list, whatever it is, orange roughy, Chilean sea bass. There are lots of names,
right,
that people give to many things. And well, for me, it just doesn't taste good anymore. Lobsters as well. You know, we think of them as a renewable resource. But we have disrupted the ocean food chains or the life chains in the ocean, consuming so many of the predators on cod that there is an unnatural abundance of lobsters that prosper, but it's out of kilter.
Right. We've interrupted the food chain again, disrupted the food chain again. And what about the oysters? I've had people on the show that talk about the oysters. I mean, I can't stand them, so that's good. But again, people should care because they are an essential part of a very important, delicate food chain balance also. And it's like, I don't get it.
I'd like to think that we could figure out how to have our oysters and eat them too. or to have
that
our
might
fish
be a Twitter quote. How can we have our oysters? Yes. I like it. I love it. Keep them and eat it too.
If it's something that we really want to have, no matter what the cost, whether it's a tuna or an oyster, then or caviar, then it's a luxury choice, and we pay the price, and we figure it out. But as far as food security, feeding people in large numbers, 7 billion people, what are they going to eat? Well, I know for sure that we cannot continue to look to the ocean as a major source of sustenance, because we have already depleted and disrupted so much that a tuna alive is worth a lot more than a tuna dead in the market on our plate, no matter how much we pay for it. I don't know how to make a tuna from scratch. Give me $1 billion, I'd still be lost. I wouldn't know how to do it.
So true.
I think that there are some ways of harnessing the cultivation of selected creatures with food security in mind. Food security means calories. It means carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. It means vitamins and minerals. It means something that's tasty and desirable and attractive, as well as being just sustenance. We feed our soul as well as our bodies,
right,
when we talk about food. But much of what we're now consuming, no one consumed early in the 20th century. People ate well, but they didn't eat tuna. People ate well, but they did not have orange roughy. They ate well, but oysters were a rare commodity once in a while, only in areas where near where oysters and people lived
right.
in close proximity. So going into the future, there are some creatures that, like chickens, and like the other animals that we cultivate and have learned to cultivate over 10,000 years of agriculture sophistication, that from sunlight through plants to animals that we consume, to have as short and efficient a food chain as possible. That is sunlight to plants to chickens. You can get sunlight into Kentucky Fried in less than a year. You can get sunlight to cows in about a year, sometimes a bit more. And it's about 20 pounds of plants to make a pound of cow, about 2 pounds of plants to make a pound of chicken. And we feed a lot of people animal protein, animal sustenance. It's not just protein, it's the fats as well as
right.
and other ingredients. But, you know, what we do know is eating animals is a choice. We don't have to eat animals to survive or even thrive. It's a choice, and it's a learned behavior. While people historically have consumed meat as a part of their diet, most of the calories that in the past and certainly in the present as well, and if there is to be a long and prosperous future, it will be the case in the future that plants will be the primary source of what food, energy that power people everywhere. And corn, rice, and wheat, the four categories, all grains, except for soy. Soy is a legume, a bean, if you will. They're very efficient at capturing sunlight and then providing food that powers us or the animals that we consume. The 80% of the calories from those four plant types alone, and the rest, all the other plants that we consume, plus the animals that we grow, plus the rather small percentage of animals that are consumed that are wild. It's small in the greater scheme of what gets consumed by humans as calories, but it's having a big impact on the ocean. And to the extent that we take bushmeat, wild animals, from the land, it's having a big impact on them as well. But, you know, generally we've stopped commercial extraction of birds. I mean, there's some that are still taken for sport or for even for sustenance, and with animals as well. The people who actually consume deer and other wild animals as a part of their sustenance or as a choice, as a sport for their pleasure. And in the ocean, sport killing, sport fishing, if you will, is engaged with as a something that some people really love to do. But it's not for sustenance, it's for choice for the most part.
And you hear about, when you're talking about the wild game, there are weird things showing up on the menus everywhere I go, and you're seeing more buffalo, and I saw elk on a menu, and things like not in the area in which that animal could have been killed, but it's that almost that insatiable taste to do the next hottest, sexiest, you know, luxury
marketing.
Item. Oh, yeah, I had elk. And it's not a hunter who's went out and got it, and the whole family, you know, it's dressed and they eat
right.
it. It's such a different...
No, there being some animals like that are being cultivated
deer
for market.
Farms. Deer farms. There are deer farms. I did that
yeah.
research. It's like, really? They could just go into New Jersey and get all the deer they wanted, because I still have friends who live there and they've got an overpopulation. They wouldn't need a deer farm.
With cultivating animals from aquatic sources, you know, there are oyster farms.
Right.
I think there's a place for that. I think, but you have to be really careful because in the ocean you're displacing wild things with what we set up as aquaculture setups. I think the most promising sources of creatures that we can consume that are in aquatic creatures are mostly freshwater things so far. That would be catfish, tilapia, and carp. They grow fast. They consume plants. They taste like whatever you want to make them taste like lemon or garlic or
yes.
onion or butter.
Kind of like tofu.
Whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can make it what you want.
That's exactly right. And so I think we just need to be aware of what we consume and what the real cost of it is. Fish alive in the ocean, wild things or birds even have an accounting base of zero. But when we take them out of the air or out of the ocean, then they become valuable. There is a value of living systems, living creatures that far outweigh the value of them when they're dead. I don't know. We just have a funny way of not accounting for nature, a peculiar way that fortunately is beginning to change. That's the good news. Once you know, once you think about it, then you can make different choices. You can be, well, more aware of what kind of future do we want.
And
we have a choice.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt, but it's like when you talk about that, and then earlier you talked about the world in which we live in terms of technology and having information literally seconds away, just at our fingertips, and the way that that has changed in our lifetime, yours and mine, from, you know, calling the operator on a phone to having every bit of knowledge you could possibly want on your phone. I mean, it was like we saw a dial-up phone about 4 years ago, and my daughter said, did they have those when you were growing up, Mom? So it's like that technology base is so, it's so out of the box, unimaginable in terms of where we are. And is that helping a lot or a little bit? Because so many people do have the possibility of knowing better. And my question sometimes after a show is, why don't they? To know better is to do better, and the oceans are at serious risk. Do you read? It's like, and I don't want to have that attitude because it sounds like judgment, but it's like people.
Well, I think things are changing. And
so give us hope.
I think there's plenty of reason for hope, and this past year is evidence of that. 2015, more of the ocean has been put into safekeeping, if you will, safeguarded, than during any time in previous human history. It's a trend that started in the 1970s when in the United States we passed legislation that made the establishment of marine sanctuaries possible. And in Australia, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority established a form of protection along that whole eastern seaboard of Australia, because the value of the living systems began to be appreciated, and the fact that they're being lost, that just as early in the 20th century, it was noticed that if we don't take proactive measures to protect wild places, they would be forever gone. So the national parks idea came into place.
Right.
We're celebrating the centennial of that next year. But I'm celebrating this year because Chile, for example, committed 1 million square kilometers of protection around the waters of their offshore islands. And last year, President Obama followed the action of George W. Bush with protection for national monuments in the sea following Theodore Roosevelt early in the 20th century, using presidential powers to really take action while there was still time to do so, to secure safe havens, in this case in the ocean. And for Roosevelt, it was mostly on the land. But now we know why it matters to do so. New Zealand also, around the Kermadec Islands, that they established a significantly large area, and the United Kingdom that has claims over big chunks of the ocean out to the edge of their exclusive economic zone, not just in their own home country, homeland, but in territories that they have offshore. So Pitcairn Island is one example in the Pacific.
Yes.
And in the Indian Ocean, UK territory, Chagos Archipelago. So now we have about 2% of the ocean secured as parks. And next year, with the centennial of the national parks, there's a potential for getting public to realize that what we did for the land in the 20th century now have the opportunity to extend into the blue part of our respective countries, especially this country, where some of these things really got a good start a century ago.
And from
blue
parks.
Go ahead, sorry. Hope spots.
I know. I love that. It was like light up, and it can be daunting at times. But from a global perspective, and Chile is such a big game changer in that whole conversation because of the fishing and their fishing practices. But as a global community, I loved your conversation with Ira Flatow about George Bush and how one conversation. It really did. It was a domino effect, and you got his attention, and he acted on it. So much credit for that. And then fast forward to Obama. How are we doing in terms of our global leadership from the United States perspective? Are we out there leading the charge for the right things?
Well, a lot of people are behind the action that resulted in George W. Bush taking the action that he did, including
Laura. And I'd love you to tell that story. I mean, it's really worth telling.
Well, I think it's Laura Bush who deserves the greatest credit, and George W. Bush himself for understanding that it matters and using his power. Others, and I'm one of many, who offered some some thoughtful reasons why it makes sense, but the action actually had to come from him. And right now, people around in this country and around the world are stepping up and saying, we need to protect the ocean. We need to have parks in the sea. And it's not just good for the fish and the whales and the shrimp and the coral reefs that we've seen their loss over the last few decades. About half the coral reefs are already gone, and it's happened with seagrass meadows and kelp forests. We're witnesses to this time of great loss, but we can also be witnesses to a time of great recovery. But it really depends on the choices that we make and letting our voices be heard. Everyone has a stake in this, and everyone can make a difference. Let people know. Let the president know that you care. Let your senators know that it's a priority. Our highest priority has to be to keep the world safe from the degradation that we have seen happening over recent decades. We have the power to turn it around. But we've vested authority in our leaders, and we have to tell them what we want, what we need to have a prosperous future, an economy that works, health that is secure. Our security depends on taking care of the natural systems that provide life. The most important thing that we extract from nature, the most important thing that we take from the ocean, is our existence. And once you understand that, and now we can, having seen Earth from afar, having looked far into the universe and seen no other place that really is suitable for 7 billion people to migrate to instantly. We have to take care of this planet as our first priority. Among whatever else it is you do with your life, make the choices that will lead to having the world be a better place than it has been during your life. It's the best gift we can give to our children and to everyone who follows.
It's just that awareness, and not just the awareness, but what are you doing to be inspired to act? And you can take one baby step. And you're right about our elected officials. We do have a voice. many people throughout the world don't. And I just say that all the time. We can vote, and it's the power of the purse. We have all the power. I just wrote something for a video I did, and I said, we've got all the power. It's called vote with your purse, or your, as if you're a Jersey girl, your pocketbook. I mean, it's like,
and with your fork.
And with your fork. Every day we go and we make choices that impact our health and the health of our kids and our grandkids and the planet. And, you know, I'm not sure how much time we have left, but we have about 5 minutes, but I want to really, there's one thing I want to cover of all the things left that I have, two more pages of questions. The American Polar Society. So here's what I want to ask you about that. You're right on the heels of participating in the 80th anniversary. So I'd love you to talk for a minute about what it is. And then, to me, the polar regions are such a microcosm of what's happening. And you can see it when you see, you know, it's overused, but when you see a polar bear, you know, breaking off on an iceberg, but so many other things. Talk about the American Polar Society, and it always blows me away. That was almost a century ago. And the people that started it, I wonder what they're thinking about where it's come and what it, you know, what its mission and purpose is now.
Early now, in the 21st century, we can see what our predecessors could not.
Right.
That polar regions are like the air conditioning system for the planet. The ocean as a whole, the polar areas in particular, drive climate and weather. And when people say to me, do you believe in climate change? I say, I don't believe or disbelieve. I just look at the evidence. And the evidence is clear.
Right.
We are driving.
Yes.
Well, it's a scientist observes carefully.
Yes.
And reports honestly.
Yes.
What is observed. And the kids can do it. Anybody can do it. Anybody can do what a scientist does. Observe carefully. Report honestly. Look at the evidence. And don't just believe what people say. Look at the results of careful observations and careful reporting. And then it's so obvious what's happening. We have the evidence from satellites, from overflights, from people on the ground, people
yes.
on and in the water. The loss of polar ice is clearly documented, and the source of why it's accelerating is connected directly to emissions primarily of carbon dioxide, but methane is another greenhouse gas that we have accelerated the transfusion of methane into the atmosphere as well. But we know what the problem is, so we have a fighting chance to find solutions, and that's exactly what people are turning to globally. There are ways that we can power civilization to transition from taking non-renewable fossil fuels, fossilized sunlight, if you will, and turn to sources that do not degrade the planet and help to restore or at least slow down the process. Some things are already in motion that are going to be hard to immediately reverse, but over time, the best we can do is to build in resilience. That would be also a reason for having protected areas on the land and the sea, to give the nature, the natural systems, the diversity of life, the carbon-capturing forests, the carbon-capturing ocean systems that take up carbon, generate oxygen, and hold the planet steady. Change is inevitable. It's the speed of change that humans right. are imposing on these systems that threaten our prosperity and our very existence, right? If we do nothing, if we just continue business as usual.
We're on the trajectory, and we have 1 minute
right.
left. And what blows me away is that I could go on for about 3 more hours listening to your stories, your passion, your evidence, your wish for the planet, which is to really and truly join everybody in protecting the vital blue heart of this planet and why.
And we can.
And we can. And now is more now. Our time is now more than ever before in the history of humankind. So, Dr. Sylvia Earle, thank you so very much from the bottom of my very green heart. And I
will. Oh, it's also blue.
It is blue. It is. I will tell you, it absolutely is. And thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to share your stories with our listeners. And our call to action is clearly, everybody, just do one thing, and it will lead to one thing, which will lead to another. And the history of mankind can be rewritten by all of us. So thank you. Many, many blessings. And I cannot wait for our paths to cross in person.
Well, here's the thing. No one person can do everything, but every person can do something.
Yes,
and
yes.
As never before, we're powerful, armed with knowledge.
We are. It's at
maybe as never again.
I agree.
A chance to use it. Yeah.
And we
got to
hurry up. So thank,
okay, thank you
so very, very much. Everybody,
right.
Make it a great green week. Thank you for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.
And blue.
And blue. Remember.